By the early 90s, traditional manufacturing had largely been abandoned in downtown Toronto. It moved to suburban areas and overseas. Empty warehouses and industrial buildings lined the streets in the King and Spadina area. But these beautiful brick Victorian factories and warehouses, with vaulted ceilings and cobblestone laneways, offer a glimpse, a link, to the city's rich industrial past that propelled Toronto from hogtown to big town. A time when leading industrialists were positioning Ontario as a manufacturing powerhouse for the country.
The way the Kings kind of manifested themselves in Toronto was that we had these old historic warehouse districts downtown on either side of the central business district that were historic because of their fabric. Certainly the buildings were all brick and beam buildings. Many North American cities have these districts, a garment district in New York, and all of the northeastern cities have these blocky warehouse districts.
Greg Lintern is the community planning director for the Scarborough and East York district at the City of Toronto. He's also a registered professional planner. Despite the fact that manufacturing was gone, zoning for the area continued as industrial, preventing any other uses in the King and Spadina area, leaving big holes of downtown Toronto derelict and empty.
There were employment areas, and we had a policy that said you can't do anything else in these areas. They're manufacturing, you know, everybody loves employment, it pays taxes, it creates jobs. From a planning, you know, let's segregate the uses point of view, that made a lot of sense. And really up until even like 1993, 94, we were saying, no, you know, we put up a barrier, like a regulation line and say, you can't cross the line with residential, you can't do any of that.
Zoning had long focused on keeping incompatible land uses separated. It was a way to prevent undesirable uses from being sited near residential areas. The idea of mixed uses in one area was not widespread at the time.
And these areas started to empty out. And cause for concern around the general economy at the time, you know, with the city in a recession, we got to do something. And there was a mayor's task force saying, okay, let's get out of the land use business, the segregation, land use segregation business in these areas, and let's let anything happen. But let's really focus on the built form and the form, what we call form-based zoning. In other words, as long as you're so big and so tall and you look like a warehouse building and you act like a warehouse building, you're good.
In 1996, a task force was set up to find a solution to the decline in the area. Members included Mayor Barbara Hall and Chief Planner Paul Bedford. They all agreed that the area had no future as a competitive industrial area. But they also agreed on the cultural value of the buildings. So what now? Something novel. They decided to ease the land use restrictions and instead focus on keeping the building form.
As long as we've got the type of building that works for the neighborhood and works for the context, why are we so concerned about the land use? So that's what the King's Initiative was about. And in King Spadina, it was about responding to people leaving town or people moving away. But also ourselves moving away as planners from a segregated land use approach. And we even took the density number. Oh my goodness, you know, planners love numbers. Well, we took that density number out too, and we said, as long as you're in this box, I don't care what your density number is.
Even though the idea was to allow a variety of land uses, conflicts were bound to happen. And they did, as new uses began to crop up in the former industrial areas.
One of the early kind of occupiers of some of this empty space were clubs. And interestingly enough, for those people who said, let's not worry about land use, and I joke, you know, with Paul about this, in came the clubs, and what do you got but a bunch of land use conflicts.
As the revitalization continued, the heritage character of the area was maintained.
We were starting to get development, and people were responding with buildings that looked and felt like the heritage fabric that was there.
What happened in the Two Kings area was a new direction for city planning in Toronto. The growth that the area had seen since the land use controls were loosened in 1996 wasn't anticipated.
For the planner geeks and others who will listen to this, there's an official plan that with words in it that guides everything that I've been talking about. And looking back on it after seeing the towers invade, I think you can safely say that all of the words in those documents were stretched to their limit and perhaps broken.
Now, the King and Spadina area is one of the most vibrant parts of downtown, with shops, apartments, places to work, and tree-lined streets that bustle with people. It set a precedent for the redevelopment of the Distillery District and other industrial sites across the province and country.
I think what is really particularly exciting is just the whole vibe, the density of it, and the amount of employment that's there, the growth in employment. Cultural industries are headquartered there.
This story marks an important turning point in the evolution of zoning. For a long time, zoning's main purpose was to separate incompatible land uses. But that course seems to be taking a turn. It's becoming more comprehensive, more flexible. Rather than restricting, zoning is encouraging complete communities, innovative businesses. It can enable people to start community gardens in underused land and help direct transit and community infrastructure to where people need it the most. We'll be hearing stories about zoning that's doing just that. We'll hear from people that are using zoning in unlikely places to create vibrant neighborhoods that enable entrepreneurial spirit. How different zoning tools can give communities a bigger stake and municipalities more teeth to direct change. One last question for you. This is an easy one. Do you know what zoning is?
Zoning? No, I have no idea what zoning is. Zoning out? Is that what the things?
That's good. That's a good idea for a title for this episode. In this episode, we're looking at trends in zoning. So no zoning out.
I'm Ross Soward.
And I'm Danielle Davis. And this is Cities Alive, bringing the city to life with stories. This is an Ontario Professional Planners Institute episode. OPPI is the recognized voice of the province's planning profession. Their more than 4,000 members work in government, private practice, universities, and not-for-profit agencies in the fields of urban and rural development, community design, social services, heritage conservation, housing, economic development, and more. So Ross, what is zoning anyways?
Well, zoning is the control by which use of land and buildings are regulated. That seems really convoluted. Let's see. Basically, land in different jurisdictions is divided up into different rates or zones that allow certain uses. It's one of the tools that planners have at their disposal that are entrenched by law. So, if you bring out your map and crayons...
All right, check.
Now think about where the best places for people to live would be, and draw some red blobs around those areas. Next, think about where these people would want to work and where they would want to shop. People want to live close to where these amenities are, so go ahead and draw a blue blob close to the red one. And we're going to need to be able to feed this city also, so we should probably try and protect some farmland around it. That's usually green.
Oh no, but my population is booming and they're starting to build into the farmland. What are these people going to eat?
And some people actually work in factories. Those factories emit smoke and don't look very nice. So where do they go? Things get complicated pretty quickly.
For more on this, we brought in an expert.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name's Victor Doyle. I'm a manager of planning at the Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing. I've been working as a planner for almost 30 years at both the provincial and municipal levels. And today's story is about zoning.
As well as being a storyteller, Victor Doyle is also a registered professional planner. The exercise of planning as we know it in Canada really took off during the rebuilding periods after both of the World Wars. Its main aim was to facilitate development and encourage business and investment. Zoning was a tool to keep apart incompatible uses, so residential areas wouldn't be right next to factories that polluted the surrounding air and water, like they did in the industrial city. This idea of separating uses is at the core of suburban development. But even though zoning was not part of a larger town planning effort, it was mostly about keeping things apart, something that Victor says is still apparent in today's zoning.
And so zoning, as it existed at the time, really wasn't designed to facilitate change, to identify how we want our new communities to develop. And while the 1946 Planning Act allowed for that through official plans, zoning really wasn't keeping in lockstep with that.
So that's when planners started introducing more nuanced zoning options.
And what they did essentially was say, previously there was only one zoning bylaw, a comprehensive zoning bylaw. And again, quite rigid, not flexible. It's all about keeping certain uses away. And so they provided different types of zoning. So now we have, as of the 1983 Planning Act, we have holding zones. So we can say to an area, you can't proceed until certain other things happen, maybe like sewer and water get put in. We have temporary use zoning, so we can allow uses on a temporary basis. We have interim control bylaws, which allow us to freeze development while studies are undertaken to determine what the best planning for an area should be. And then we also introduced what is called site plan control. So this allows for more detailed regulation of an individual commercial or multi-residential building, typically not applied to individual houses. And so under site plan, municipalities could now start to regulate parking, ingress, egress, landscaping, fencing, all those things that they didn't have control with under the former zoning bylaws, and which they forced rezoning applications in order to allow them to obtain.
Although we have these new zoning tools that allow for more flexibility, old restrictive zoning often stays in place because changing zoning of an area isn't easy. Municipalities often have their hands full with other applications. So it usually happens when a developer proposes a development and applies for rezoning.
So what they tended to do was leave, even though they changed their official plans to say this area is going to develop or redevelop in the case of some of the built-up areas, they left the old zoning in place, sometimes agricultural or sometimes really outdated zoning. And they did this because that would force the development proponent to apply for a rezoning. And in so doing, it had to get council's approval. And this gave them all sorts of leverage then to require other things that they would want to lead to a well-planned development. And so they would essentially negotiate or hold up the approval of the rezoning until a developer agreed to meet their requirements in relation to parking or expropriating land for right-of-ways, negotiating ingress and egress, very detailed things that are hard to set out in a zoning bylaw ahead of time. And they also used it to leverage things, community benefits for the municipality. So for instance, parkland, some other types of amenities where the developer would provide these in order to get the approval for the rezoning. And then they would lock that all down through development agreements as part of the rezoning in order to force the developer to uphold their promises.
So even today, municipalities mostly maintain the old zoning of an area unless someone proposes to redevelop a site. That means zoning often doesn't reflect the needs of the current community and can restrict people in ways that seem unnecessary.
And it seems so simple, like, you know, why not? Why wouldn't you do this? But it's actually really unprecedented. This, how rezoning works is usually someone comes from the outside, says, I have a property, I want to do something different. And then they pay the city to go through the process of doing a rezoning. Where here, the city saying, we on your behalf to a bunch of owners are going to rezone this, was kind of, had never really been done before.
I came to Canada with two of my sons in 2006 on April 5. My name is Astier Teklizikabado.
And I'm Yuwa Yamana Mengus.
Astor and her two sons immigrated to Canada as refugees. Her family was chased out of their middle-class life in Eritrea. In the turmoil, her husband and her eldest son were kidnapped, and she hasn't seen them since. They eventually ended up at a refugee camp in Ghana, and finally in Toronto, which is where I met them.
We moved to Teesdale Place. We were at first at a shelter.
Yeah.
For how long? For a month?
For
2 months. And then we got the, you know, we found some people that can get us a place, and we found Teesdale. So, yeah, the place was good. It was a big space. We only had one bedroom. Me and Mom would sleep in the same bed, and then Bibna would have his own little bed.
Teesdale is one of Toronto's many tower neighborhoods, concentrated areas of high-rises in the inner suburbs that have become the landing pad for thousands of immigrants to Canada.
If people aren't familiar with them, if you haven't been to places like this, they're usually a lot of open space around these buildings. They usually come in groups, so you won't usually find a tower on its own. They'll come in groups of 2, 3, 4, sometimes as much as 15, 20 of these apartment buildings. They have a lot of landscape and trees and a lot of surface parking.
That's Graham Stewart. He's an architect and registered professional planner. He became a passionate researcher of tower neighborhoods in school, and has become one of the driving forces behind Toronto's multifaceted tower renewal project.
So when we think of a North American city, we usually think of cities that have dense cores and then increasingly less dense areas that bleed into the suburbs and the exurbs. Where in Toronto, we have a strange configuration where some of the highest density neighborhoods are actually in the suburbs, whether it's parts of Jane Finch or Thorncliffe Park or North Rexdale. These are areas that have hundreds of apartment buildings, thousands of people living there. Some of them are home to as much as 30,000 people. So that's the sort of the size of cities in these sort of suburban tower blocks.
These kinds of cities in the suburbs are very unique to Canada and turn up in other places like Ottawa, Montreal, Winnipeg, and Edmonton. They were developed in the 50s and 60s as mid-market apartments, kind of like condo neighborhoods today. At the time, they were very fashionable. Airy, bright, cool, and forward-thinking.
The early advertisements for these buildings showed people driving convertibles and having martini parties and, you know, going to this sauna, you know, stuff like that.
Once home to mostly middle-class families and young professionals, the demographics of the people living in these neighborhoods has shifted dramatically.
So they became kind of the arrival cities, or the arrival zones, in the city. So it's a bit of a demographic swap. So it went from the first 15, 20 years to kind of the boomers and the yuppies, and then it switched into landing pads for newcomers. And that's sort of been a true trend to this day. And so one of the things that's sort of a somewhat of an unintended consequence, but really important about these buildings, is that if we didn't have them, if there wasn't this ready stock of apartment housing all over the region, a lot of them are 2, 3, 4 bedroom apartment, they're big enough for families, it probably would have been a lot more difficult to absorb so successfully so many newcomers. And so the fact that we had these, even though they weren't designed or planned for them, made it so that there was an ability for the region to become so open to the world.
So it's no surprise that new immigrants like Astor Newell ended up in a tower neighborhood in the inner suburbs. These places are often far from the essential social services, public transit, and other resources that they need.
You know, it's hard because the transportation there was, the Victoria Park Station was very far from us. You had to wait like 20 minutes for the bus and then like 20 minutes bus ride to Victoria Park, which is far.
With $80 a month to feed their family, the food bank became a vital social service for them. It's when they started making friends, volunteering, and integrating into a new society. But it wasn't exactly close. They walked 30 minutes each way, summer through winter, because they couldn't afford the transit.
So the challenges, and there are many, one is that the buildings are getting older and they need investment to stick around for another life cycle. So 50 years is about a life cycle for a building. To last another 50 years, they're going to need investment. But some of the more quality of life and livability things is a really simple fact that these buildings were always conceived to be places that you would drive to. the demographic changes that have happened with them becoming the homes for a lot of newcomers, and is that car ownership is down. Another big demographic is seniors, so people who've lived there for years and they've continued to live there and they're driving less. And then probably the most surprising and the biggest change in demographic is kids. So some of these neighborhoods have the highest concentrations of children under 12 than anywhere in the city, largely because of large newcomer families. So kids also don't drive cars. So you have the situation where the majority of people living in the tower blocks just don't have access to a car.
Much of our work over the past decade has really focused on community infrastructure needs, essentially social services. Because what we knew is that even though poverty had grown quite dramatically in the inner suburbs and in fact had remained flat or declined in the downtown core, the majority of community services were still in the downtown core 10 years ago because that traditionally that's where the need had been. And the suburbs outside of downtown core had really been residential neighborhoods, middle class neighborhoods, where a service infrastructure had not emerged. So if I hold it like this, is this good?
Yeah, that's good.
Great.
Yeah.
And is it still rolling?
It's still rolling. As long as, I don't know if you can see the numbers there, but as long as the numbers are going.
I can see the numbers.
Okay,
so
great.
I will actually look at the numbers.
My name is Pedro Barada. I am Vice President of Communications and Public Affairs at United Way Toronto and York Region.
Research by the United Way has seen growing gaps in opportunity playing out a lot in our cities. Lack of affordable housing, employment opportunities, lack of access to public transit, social services, green space and schools are all contributing factors. Why is this happening, and what are some of the strategies we can use to close this gap? Pedro explained that although most people think that financial investment is the main way to reduce poverty, there are a number of other key levers we can pull that have a big impact, and one of them is zoning.
We kind of looked at this as zoning equity. And what that means is when you go to a place like a main street in most parts of the city, there's like, your butcher, your baker, your corner store, your pharmacy, it's got the stuff that makes a neighborhood work. When you also look at the language around the planning of the city and the province, they have this thing called complete communities. And there's this idea that there's a goal that all communities should be complete communities. And what that means is it's that you have all the needs you need in daily life within walking distance. You have access to transit, you have access to job potential. And if you happen to be commuting to somewhere else in the city for your job, there's good commuting options. And if you happen to stay in the neighborhood, there's good walking options and the whole bit, that there's different housing types, et cetera, et cetera. It's a pretty great thing. It's like, way to go for writing this. It's excellent. So all we did is say, let's look at the statement of complete communities and say, do these neighborhoods meet that? Currently, they don't. Currently, they don't have those things that make a community fully work. And not only do they not, they don't have, legally, it's impossible for them to be. So like, we have to change this.
Graham spent a lot of time in these communities doing research. And counter to what most people think of as undesirable slums, he found time and time again, really vibrant communities. These are people's homes, and almost a million people in the region live in them now. So instead of thinking of tearing them down, people started to think about how they could be retrofitted to make them better.
So when we looked at this, we looked at how can you make these neighborhoods more healthy, more convenient, and then have a higher quality of life with some simple changes. And we did a big study for Toronto Public Health, and it looked at a series of measures, all of them really simple. How do you bring fresh food to the neighborhoods? How do you bring community services? How do you bring all the great stuff that the city of Toronto has on offer just right to where high density is? You already have a captive market for these things. And what we found is that the vast majority of these recommendations were against the zoning bylaws.
The major issue was that the zoning of the tower neighborhoods hadn't been changed since they were built in the 50s and 60s.
It just didn't make any sense in today's reality. It didn't reflect at all what the communities were about today. And in fact, they made them really restrictive, and they would have clauses that would limit all commercial use, sometimes all institutional use, so that, without, not on purpose, but just incidentally, cuts out programs like United Way, programs like social service delivery, things like public health nurses coming and offering flu shots. All these things became ambiguous, like, is it allowed or isn't it? And no one could really tell. And There were some stories we heard of after-school groups who wanted to run, like, you know, like a nonprofit who wanted to run like an after-school homework group for kids. And the lawyers of the owner just said, you know what, I don't think we can let you do this, because when we read the zoning bylaw, we're just nervous about it. We don't think we're allowed to do this. And it's not that the owners are jerks. It's just that, you know, they're just trying to abide by what they think the bylaw says.
So what are the current demographics looking for in a neighborhood?
So the first thing is education for us. You know, it's like when she was looking for a place, the first question she would ask is school. Where's the school? Is it close here? Is it close there? Mm-hmm. And the other thing is shopping. You know, what's surrounding you? You know, is there no frills around you? Is there anything like that's food basics, if anything like that? So that's one of the things that's important for her.
Hospital command.
Oh yeah, in the hospital, you know, like.
In Graham's research, he found that in cities around the world, like Moscow and Paris, they're retrofitting their high-rise neighborhoods, adding green spaces, bike paths, transportation hubs, and commercial spaces. So they've become really vibrant.
So before the wall came down, these were some of the most restricted, like, you know, people weren't able to do no commerce at all kind of in the base of these buildings because it was the Soviet Union. You go there now and it's like a carnival. Like, it's absolutely bananas. Like, you see a row of tower blocks on the ground floor, people selling fruit and vegetables. It'll be like, come to the fourth floor to get a haircut. It'll be people selling, you know, books. There's informal libraries. It's people with markets, sort of flea markets, selling clothes and other things. This like really robust kind of grassroots economy, which right now is kind of stuff that only happens in kind of like gentrified downtown neighborhoods, and it shows that this stuff can happen anywhere.
But back in Toronto.
When we went into tower neighborhoods and really started our tower neighborhood renewal project, our aim was to really look for opportunities to create community life and to create community supports in these towers. And so we were looking at the use of space in a creative way, right? So if there's a parking lot that's being underutilized and residents are very interested in creating playgrounds or community gardens, we should try and do that. If there are units that are underutilized or have high turnover rates, especially if they're on the ground floor, and there's this growing synergy between the property manager, the residents, community agencies, to turn that space into community space and offer some programming that provides eyes on the street, programs for seniors, before and after school programs for kids, settlement, language, nutrition, all that kind of stuff, then let's work together to make it happen.
So this, you know, this became a pretty clear thing that needed to get changed. And so working with the United Way, Toronto Public Health, and a whole host of other partners, we began to approach the city and just say, this is what we're finding. And so we wrote a position paper, I guess, that sort of went through and explained like what all the issues were. And then we met with the city, we met with the planning department, and they were really open to it. They were saying, we agree with you. This is something that needs to be done. It's just, it's really challenging to get direction for them to do this. They have so many files they're working on any given time. To put staff time to it is really difficult. But they were, you know, they absolutely concurred that it was a challenge. So then we decided, how do we put this on the agenda? So again, this is during the Rob Ford years, so it was a bit tricky to think like, okay, how during the Rob Ford years do we put something like this on the agenda? And we realized that we have to start talking to counselors, start talking to people who live in these neighborhoods, get a real consensus about, do people agree with this change and do they want it? And what we found with talking to residents and then talking to counselors is that everyone saw this as a no-brainer. It really is. Why can't there be grocery stores, small-scale grocery stores on these sites? Why can't someone start a small business? Why can't public health offer services? You know, all these things. And one of the things that we found is that a lot of the people living in these neighborhoods, especially newcomers, are these amazing risk takers. They've traveled halfway around the world to get here. Then they come to Canada expecting, you know, I can be innovative. I can start a business. I can do all these things, be a social entrepreneur. And then they, you know, arrive in a tower block in Scarborough and realize they're not allowed to do anything. And so it's pretty defeating. And so the biggest charge that we felt is hearing the residents who are like, I want to do stuff, you know, like just let me do stuff. And so we brought that story to the councillors, and they were really supportive. And so we brought it to executive committee, and we made the case that, you know, this is something we think should the city should look into. And they agreed. It was unanimous support. They then directed planning and the zoning committee, who was at the same time looking at the whole amalgamated citywide rezoning, and put it on the agenda. And then from there was about a year period where we were working hand in hand with the zoning team and the planners at the city. They were totally amazing. They really took the lead, and they rewrote the zoning for 500 sites, and then put it through as a city-initiated top-down rezoning.
A critical piece of this was the inclusive process that went along with changing the zoning.
The new class, the new zoning class, essentially lists a whole number of uses around what is permitted now or what will be permitted now that was not permitted before. And I think that that list is really reflective of many of the things that came forward in terms of where residents saw barriers to creating, you know, community activity, social activity, economic activity that could be unleashed by changing some of those rules. Simple things. Running a part-time business out of my apartment, be it, you know, a part-time barbershop for some of my neighbors, or opening up a second door to the tuck shop downstairs so that, you know, you don't have to be a resident of that building in order to get into that tuck shop and buy my groceries. And in fact, you can create a door to the outside, which right now previously was not allowed by the rules. And it essentially meant that if residents from other towers wanted to access that grocery store, they had to find somebody to let them in.
And so the RAC zone was born. RAC stands for Residential Apartment Commercial Zone. And as the name implies, it aims to enable the entrepreneurial spirit in these residential tower neighborhoods.
For things to happen, you need to have people willing to take the risk to start a business and, you know, spend money on it. And so the fact that there's really flexible kind of, you know, low capital, high impact things like pop-ups that this allows for is really exciting. And the United Way and Public Health and the city are working on sort of some pop-up pilots to say, let's work with residents. And actually, once this is finally legal, let's actually do some stuff and get this started. So that's very, very cool, very exciting.
And fast forward to now, and how shrink wrap zoning no longer works, and in fact should be loosened and should be much more responsive to the realities of those neighborhoods. That has been a really interesting journey. And for us, it's been a really transformative journey in terms of how community, residents, private sector, and planners have worked together in new ways where we haven't worked together like this before to really rewrite the zoning code as it applies to tower neighborhoods.
Instead of waiting for a developer to force a rezoning, the municipality initiated the zoning change in response to a community-based vision.
One of the things I find interesting as an architect is that people for years have said this building form is one where community doesn't work well, and the, you know, it's the form that doesn't work, and, you know, no matter what you do, there's never going to be community life in these places. And I think what this shows is that that's not true. What's true is that the system around spaces is where it can change community life or not. So here, the invisible thing of zoning that says thou shall not do the following has suppressed a commercial culture in these spaces.
In the end, having a safe, strong community of caring people and economic opportunities is more important to most people than the architectural detail of their apartments.
But the other thing is, you know, friends. I think that's the most important thing, who you're surrounded by. And if they're really, like, we were surrounded by genuine, really nice, amazing people that just genuinely cared about us, you know, cared about us. They didn't have to care about us. They didn't know us at all. You know, we were just a bunch of people that came from Africa trying to live a good life. But and we met these amazing people, and, you know, they gave us the strength. If it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be in this position, because, you know, it's hard for mom because she's a single mother and, you know, and stuff like that. But when she found, like, good friends and, you know, just her spirit was just, and her energy was just, you know, getting higher and higher, and it made her work a little harder.
Yeah. From donated clothes to caps and gowns, it's a little shout to my black and brown folks that know the game, not in class to clown. Had the funny accent, well, look who's laughing now. See, Samir came here to grind, and he slaved at every minimum wage job, but he saved that. Brought his sister on scholarship to make stacks, working as a surgeon, she bought a whip and paid cash. No time to whine, we just face facts. Let's fit six in the back and let's take that to the best restaurants, make reservations. Since we out here, since they made reservations for First Nations and they never made reparations, the natives probably relate more to immigration. So this for y'all too, when I can't forget the Haitians here for an education. It's a celebration. Not bad, huh?
The idea of making zoning more open and flexible seems to be the way that things are trending. And that reflects larger shifts that are happening in our cities and society. In the next episode, we're going to learn about some of these larger demographic shifts that are happening and the effect they're having on where we live and how we zone. How can we be more proactive with zoning to create the kind of communities that we want to live in? We'll find out next time. In Zoning Out, Part 2.
You've been listening to Cities Alive, the podcast. This is an OPPI podcast. It was created and produced by Danielle Davis, Jordy Gordon, Joel Sajonki, and me, Ross Soward.
And we also want to thank the musicians who contributed their songs to these episodes, Eloquent and Chad. If you haven't already, please go check them out. They're awesome.
For more Cities Alive episodes, subscribe to Cities Alive on iTunes or stream Cities Alive at pdcenter.ca.